The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Marie Arana is the inaugural literary director of the Library of Congress and former longtime editor-in-chief of the Washington Post's literary section, Book World. Her memoir, American Chica, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Other work includes the novel Cellophane, a biography of the Latin American liberator Simón Bolívar, and the nonfiction book Silver, Sword, and Stone. A raft of awards from her long career in letters includes a 2020 award for her lifetime work in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the 2021 Library of Congress Award for Superior Service. This evening, she brings her new book, Latino Land. She'll be joined in conversation with Elizabeth Perez Luna, contributor to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and former executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Marie, I'm sorry I made a porcupine out of your book with all these notes. But, Marie, not Maria or not Mary, Marie Arana was born in Lima. I'm not sure that I'm repeating but I might re-repeat it. It's worth repeating. And she was born in 1949. She's a prolific writer, editor, essayist, linguist, all sorts of contemporary literature analyst. She's a former editor-in-chief for the Washington Post Book World, and she's still a regular columnist for the newspaper. Actually, as a matter of fact, we're going to talk about an article she wrote last week on politics and elections. She has the lucky of commuting between Washington, D.C. and Lima. Can you imagine? What a life. And inaugural literary director of the Library of Congress. And I finally asked her, what does that mean? And means that she brought contemporary literature into the Library of Congress. So she was instrumental in bringing a new voices to the library. She's a linguist too. Mm-hmm. She speaks Mandarin, having studied at the Mandarin language at Yale University in China, and Russian, because she was interested in languages, so why not do two easy languages, you know? And it would take me too much of your time to go through all the things that you have
done.
Thank
you, Elizabeth.
And she has a great, it's mariaarana.net, and Wikipedia has all the information you would want about the details of her life and her work.
Not everything.
No, exactly. So you would need another big book to just the things you've done. She has four children, two adopted children, and two of her own children, two of her husband's children. So Marie, in your work, you've navigated. I've followed your work for a while. The writer's work was as an essayist, a memoirist with American Chica, which was a finalist at the National Book Award about growing up bilingual, novelist with Cellophane and Limonites, and historian with the biography of Simón Bolívar, among other things. They're all about Latino and Latin American themes, of course, and they're all different facets of your Latino identity, and it seems that it all comes together in your latest book. But I don't think you woke up one morning and said, basta, I need to write about a portrait of America's largest and least understood minority. It will be 550 pages, and I will name it Latino Land. That's not how it happened. So let me know how Latino Land was born out of all this wealth of work that you're doing.
It was a long road. It really was a long road. And it was a sort of a wandering road. I knew that I didn't want to write the same book twice, and I didn't want to write the same genre even twice, starting with a memoir. What I wanted to do was describe Latin Americans and Latinos for people who weren't Latin Americans or Latinos. And it ended up being that there was a lot of interest from Latin Americans and from Latinos for this subject. And so I started going from one thing to another. I began with my own story of American Chica, which was about my life between countries and between, shall we say, identities, and living on a bridge, and being the translator. My mother was American, my father Peruvian, being the translator for both, you know, and sort of negotiating that bridge all my life, and not really feeling one thing or the other at any time. So that was how I began, and then I wanted to write a novel, of sort of an epic novel about a family just in general. And I drew from my family to write Cellophane, which is set in the jungle of Peru, in the rainforest, the Amazon. And it was absolute joy to write, because it was, I could pull from all my family the amazing stories that I heard as a child, and the people that I met, who were characters, incredible characters, and I could feed them into this sort of satire about family life in Peru. And then Lima Nights, and I wanted to write a novel, but that was urban and sharp and a love story and sort of arch. And I did that. It was very slender. I wrote it in 4 months. It was, you know, quite a different book from the epic novel of Cellophane. And then I challenged myself to, I had been an editor all my life. I had been an editor at Harcourt Brace Ivanovich, and I had been an editor at Simon Schuster. So writing was not new to me. Editing was not new to me. So I don't want you to think that I had never done a biography before, because I had edited many biographies before as a professional. So I decided to write a biography, and I wanted to find somebody whose life spanned the most geography of anyone I could think of, and whose family spanned most years. And of course, for me, that became Simón Bolívar. I was always, I had two ancestors who fought against one another in the Battle of Ayacucho, which won Peru's independence and also ended for good the colonial world of Spain in Latin America. So I was interested in Bolívar from the start. I also wondered why Peruvians were so hated Bolívar. You know, my father thought he was a minor character, even though he was a huge character. But the tendency for Peruvians to put him down was really striking to me. So here was a man whose family life spanned 300 years in the New World, and who liberated six republics,
right,
all the way, and who had traveled all the way from the Caribbean all the way down to Bolivia.
And he went a lot to Haiti to learn a lot about the independence movement.
The only support he got was from Haiti. The United States didn't want to support him,
right,
because the United States was, at that point, operating on a slave economy. And Bolivar's instinct was immediately to free the slaves. And promised, in fact, Petion, who was the president Petion of Haiti, that he would free all the slaves.
Right.
So the United States never helped him, but Haiti did. So from there, I thought, well, where do I go now? I've done a biography, I've done a memoir, I've done fiction. And then I decided to really, I was talking with my aunt, who was also my madrina, my godmother, and I said, you know, the writing about Bolivar really convinced me that the heart of the difference between Latin Americans and North Americans was the revolutions that they lived through. And she said, well, if you really believe that, you know, explain it more. And I said, no, there's a very huge difference between the Americas, and I think that is where the difference is most extreme. And so I took up her challenge. She said, write about that. And to write about that, I had to write about all the problems that were faced in the Wars of Independence and before the whole colonial life, and all the problems that still persist in Latin America. So that's what I wrote. And in the process of writing all of these books, they all took place in Latin America. It became obvious to me that here we were in my lifetime. In my lifetime, I had come when there were 2 million Latinos counted, Hispanics, Latinx, whatever you want to call us, counted in this country, 2 million. And now there are 64 million in my lifetime. So I thought, my God, how can I ignore this population? It's the size, it's larger than any Spanish-speaking country in the world except Mexico. Imagine that. It's bigger than Venezuela, bigger than Colombia, this population of Latinos. That's how I decided to do this book.
Yet I think one of the points you make in the book, and that's why you use this intriguing title, is that it is not understood or known as well as it should be. There's Latinos are still seen as recent immigrants and all immigrants, and you make a point in your book that Latinos are not all immigrants. That how many are born here? You said there was an
64
enormous
million. Yeah, 64 million. I mean, it's astonishing amount
right.
of
so
of
it's
population.
Not it's just a story of immigration.
Right.
But one of the things that's intriguing is that there are few aspects of American U.S. American life that does not have some sort of a Latin tinge.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I made a quick list, but it you know, language, food, music, culture, all sorts of other things.
Science. Yeah.
Science. Except that not politics. And it doesn't seem that politics is an important aspect of Latino life.
Not American politics, no.
Yes.
No, that is not. You know, there is such, what you say is so important, that we are seen perpetually as arriving. Whereas, you know, we have been here, Hispanics, Latinos, fought in the American Revolution. There was a whole river of Latin people who came up from the Caribbean and from the Central America and from Mexico to fight in the revolution, led by the Spanish forces that were sitting down, of course, in New Orleans and Florida. So from the very beginning, there was, and George Washington said, by the way, I could not have won this war without the Hispanic help. Why? Because the British had blocked the river access, and the only way that the George Washington and his troops could get ammunition was from the Spanish, who were bringing it up under no flag. And so in the Revolution, in the Civil War, and every war, there was a greater and greater mass of military that were Hispanic. And in fact, today, 26% of all United States Marines are Hispanic. It's huge. One out of every four, more than one out of every four. And so that sense that we are always, that we are we've just arrived, is just absolutely not true.
So those are some of the main aspects that are misunderstood, and mm-hmm. and I think the the question comes is that we see publication after publication in articles, in books, in which all of a sudden they're discovering, oh, the first Latino to do this and the first Latino to do that. And yet, so that creates an atmosphere of newcomers finally making it into the American ideal, or how do you negotiate that? Because I think one of your points with this book, if I understood it correctly, is that you wanted not only U.S. Americans. I'm trying to make the difference, so because Americans were all Americans, but U.S. Americans, but Latinos themselves don't know their own history in this country. So I think one of your points, it seems to me, in your book, is to create an atmosphere in which you want to learn more, in which you just, it's not haphazard that you use words in Spanish, like a poor owl in New York that was called, what is it? El qué? El flaco. Why is it? Yeah. All New Yorkers are crying about the poor owl. Anyway, so how do you, am I correct in saying that that's one of your goals, if you will, with this book? It's like, open up your eyes, learn.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, because, yes, I mean, just look around. You look at, you talk about people saying the first Latino to do this, Lynn, but if you look at the first Latinos, it goes way back. I mean, the first admiral of the United States Navy was a Latino, and he fought in the Civil War, and he was the one who said, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." That was David. His name was actually Farragut. It was David Farragut. And you can see his statue in the middle of, you know, just steps from the White House, in the middle of Washington, D.C. And you can see his bust in the Army Navy Club in Washington, D.C. And nobody goes by and says, oh, you know, Hispanic hero. Stephen Vincent Benet, who was a writer, a very famous writer in the United States, his father was Esteban Benet. And he was the head of all ordnance, which means ammunition, from West Point. He was in West Point commanding all the ordnance that was used in the Civil War. And he was from St. Augustine, Florida. He was Spanish. He had some Caribbean blood as well, but he was a Latino. And what you say is so important, because this is something, Latinos don't know this even, because it's not in the school books and it's not in the textbooks. This sort of information is legion. I mean, there's so much of it, but we're just not taught it, and we're not. It's not framed as these incredible contributions that the population has made to American history.
And it's true. You say you mention at one point in your book, I think at the beginning of your book, if I can find my notes. That's also another problem.
they're there.
Yeah. I mean, being in book clubs gives you the ability to find notes and to quote pages. But you were talking about that Latinos are not a unity, but the life in the United States had kind of forced us into believe so, into look at a unity. And one of the series I did for NPR had to do with four major cities that had completely different Latino populations. So let's talk a little about that. It was New York, LA, San Antonio, and Miami. Those are four major cities with enormous Latino presence and power, mm-hmm. yet it's not
And very different histories, too.
Yes.
Very different
yes.
histories. I mean, for the Mexicans, who make up 37 million of the 64 million, so they're the predominant Mexicans. And at one time, that 2 million that I mentioned at the beginning, when I first came to the United States as an immigrant, the 2 million was largely Mexican-Americans. And you have to remember that they were Mexican-Americans because the United States invaded the Spanish territory. What happened, of course, when James Polk said, take your stick and go out there and westward ho, and we're going to, you know, this is manifest destiny. This is where we were made to be coast to coast, so go get it. And what it was, we don't read this in the textbooks, but what it was an invasion of Mexican land. It was an invasion of the Spanish colonial territory at the time. The revolution had just been fought and won, but it was that this was Mexican land, and so the great pioneer movement, and we all see it as this wonderful, you know, pioneer movement, was actually an invasion of foreign land and foreign territory. Thomas Jefferson was surprised and appalled at the way that it was being managed. He had always thought that that the United States would own South America, but not in that way. I mean, he envisioned buying it as opposed to invading it. But so that was how the Mexicans came to be. And when they say the border crossed us, we didn't cross the border. That's why. That's how the Mexicans became Americans. When they became Americans, by the way, I should say that Mexico, knowing that it was leaving these Mexicans behind because they didn't want to leave their land. They had been there for generations, for hundreds of years. They had come in 1601, and this was now 1848, and they had had generations of people on the land they didn't want to leave. And Mexico said to the United States, all right, you must make Mexicans white so that they can vote. Because in this country, if you were black, you could not vote. And they wanted to make sure that you could, that the Mexicans they left behind could vote. So Mexicans became white, and so they weren't counted because they were, you know, they were, we don't know really how many Mexicans then became part of the citizenry because, you know, they weren't necessarily counted. They were counted as white, and they still do. And then, of course, as history moved on, and the Spanish-American War was fought, the United States occupied Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico then became an American territory. They were not given citizens' rights. You cannot vote for a president if you're Puerto Ricania, and you cannot you could serve in the military, certainly, and they do in great numbers. The Puerto Rican battalions have been amazing, extraordinary, but they can't vote and they can't have constitutional rights.
Right.
So, and then of course there was the occupation of Cuba, which the United States decided to leave behind because they were already had so much influence in Cuba that they didn't need to own it at that point. So, and this is where the tremendous influence of the United States on eventually the Batista government, which was the very thing, the very corrupt system that Fidel Castro fought against. And then, of course, there was the wave of Cubans who came up after the revolution. So you've had the Puerto Ricanos going and the Dominicanos going to New York. You had the Cubans going to flooding into Florida so furiously that they were sending their children. People really know enough about the Pedro Panes, who were sent over as children as young as 4 years old, sent by themselves, put on planes, sent 14,000 of them. Some of them didn't see their parents again for 4 to 5 years. Quite a few did not see their parents for 35 years. They were bandied around the country in different places. And remarkably, some of them have become incredibly successful.
Right.
The one that I interview for the book became the CEO of AT&T. So you have these waves of people coming in. It started really with the Mexicans invasion of Mexico, but then with the occupation of Puerto Rico, with the really domination of Cuba, and the Dominican Republic.
Right.
So you have, you know, these pockets around the country. When you come, I mean, I'm Peruvian, you're Venezuelan. When you come, you think of yourself as a Venezolana or a Peruana. You don't think of yourself as anything bigger than that. And then you come to this country, and there's this community of Latin Americans that you suddenly are considered a part of. And really interestingly, people accept the label. And if you are Latino, Latina, you find that you are socializing across, you know, the countries that it in fact may have gone to war against one another at one time. So it's really interesting how these pockets of you know, very separate identities, very diverse groups. So there was very little in common, really, except for the feeling of Latinidad between a Cuban and a Mexican, right? Or between a Dominican and a Cuban.
You know, you remind me of a quote in your book in which you said, when you talk about your own trajectory, your parents bifurcated. You were the bifurcated child of your parents, and you became destined to shuttle between two irreconcilable worlds, and that you love beyond expression, and that taken separately could never truly be called home.
Yeah.
And that was very telling, because it's a very important aspect of immigration.
Yes.
Is that you belong to your new country, but there is this double standard that you are superimposed on.
Yes.
And how do you negotiate that? Because I want to get to the point in which we can talk about the consequences of not being aware of this history. I mean, if we talk about Farragut and it's one person, oh great, we had one person in the army, but it's not one person, it's a whole generation of people. Yes. Who have built the history, our history,
right.
American history.
Right.
So how do you negotiate that bifurcation, and
well,
where
really
do you feel
interesting.
When you get home? Yeah. What's home?
Yeah, what's home? It's really interesting because, you know, this country is made of many, many waves of immigration. And the there is, in a part of this, you cannot avoid it, is the question of race and ethnicity. You know, we are, the Latinos are a mixed race. We have been for over 500 years. It was an extraordinary experiment, when you think of it, to mix races as promiscuously as Spain did with the indigenous, and then eventually with the black population that was brought in. People don't realize that in the 12 million people, Africans, who were enslaved and shoved onto ships and kidnapped and brought to the Americas, of the 12 million, 1 million died en route. 11 million actually made it to the Americas. 350,000 came to the United States. All the rest, 10 million plus, went to Latin America. We have a huge population of African Latinos, and most of us have some African blood. I do. I have African blood. I have Asian blood from the Asian immigration that came in Peru, especially. A lot of Japanese, a lot of Chinese. We are the most mixed race, and have been for hundreds of years, group on the planet. So when you think of that, we come to this country as already mixed.
Right.
So it's a very, it's a sort of an interesting immigration because we can, we're like chameleons. We can go into any, you know, the Dominicans and the Puerto Ricans, they live with, in the black communities and are very comfortable. The Cubans slip into whiteness in the United States. The Mexicans who were called white, but treated as second-class citizens and called brown and treated very differently from the white label that they were actually officially given. So when you have this sort of immigration in which we are already products of immigration and very strong, strongly so, it's a very different thing than coming from Sweden, you know, and being Swedish immigrants, or coming from Ireland and being Irish immigrants. We already are the products of immigration in a very different way than those groups.
Right. Well, it's not to say that there's no racism in Latin America.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, racism is racism, but it's a different tinge of it. I mean,
it was law by the Spanish colonial system. You know, they had grids, and you can see this. Look it up. They had grids in which, you know, the different race mixing and what the names that they would have for them. One was called salto para atrás. You know, if an Asian married a black, you were a salto para atrás,
which is a step backwards.
Right, step backwards. they were very very racist, and
right.
this is really. It shouldn't be amusing. It's pretty terrible. But in the Spanish colonial system, you could buy whiteness. You could go to the church and say, "I have all this money. I'm not the right color, but I have all this money, so I'm going to buy what they called a cédula de gracias." Cédula de gracias meant that you paid the money to the church, and then you could be legally white. So then you could work, have certain jobs, teach. So, you know, it was a very fluid and very racist system that Spain built.
Right. I wanted to read another quote that you mentioned by the writer Reina Grande, the Mexican-American writer, which is, it's in your chapter called Devil's Highway. "I thought I was done with borders. I didn't know there would be more to be crossed, cultural borders, language borders, legal borders, gender and career borders," which is very telling because it's a never-ending quest.
Right, it's a never-ending crossing.
Yes.
Reina Grande actually walked across the border when she was 6 or 7 years old with her father. And she feels, she writes, she's a very interesting writer, I recommend her, she feels she's never stopped crossing borders. It's constant very, very present being a Mexican in California.
Well, I mean, sometimes there's borders in a city, neighborhood yeah. borders, you know certain streets. A lot of African Americans, they know exactly what side of one main street they can go on without any trouble, or what side they might get into trouble. So it's the borders are a constant presence. So, what are some of the consequences, both among U.S. Americans and even Latinos, of not knowing enough about this history and this presence? Because that presence and that is also a source of power.
Yeah.
So, what are the consequences of being ignorant or not knowledgeable, let's not be nasty, not knowledgeable enough about the history of the country we're in?
It's a very good question. I've just actually finished writing an article for the New York Times, which is coming out within the next week. What is the result of that? Not knowing, not being in the textbooks, not being aware of our history and having that shut out, and having it shut out not only from the whole population but from us, is erasure. It's invisibility. It is the fact that that sense that we've just gotten here, you know. And it's that invisibility, I think, that that keeps boardrooms from not having Latinos. Latinos have something like 1% of the boardrooms of this country. 1% is, although, you know, we are now 20% of the country. And by 2060, we're going to be 30% of people will have Latino heritage. 1% in the boardrooms, which is extraordinary, really. That's what happens when you don't when you don't know your own population, and the U.S. doesn't, and even we, the Latinos, don't.
Two things. I inevitably get asked what's best to say, Hispanic, Latino, Latinx, Chicano, Tejano, New Yorkeño, and so on and so forth. What works best?
Well, this is my introduction is on the very fact that we really don't have a name. We've been shuffled around with different names. You know, we were called Latinos, and Latin America was called Latin America by all people, Napoleon, because he had designs on taking over when Napoleon invaded Spain and conquered Spain for the time that he did. He had these illusions that all those colonies that Spain had in the Americas were now going to be his. And to persuade the people that they were already related to Napoleon and the French, he called us in Latin America Latinos, Latin. We're Latin, just like us, French. So that was imposed. And then come the 70s with Richard Nixon, he decided that he wanted to create an electorate out of the people that he knew so well. He was from California. His father was a grocer. His father and he, as a boy, would work with the agricultural workers because that was where the produce came from for the grocery shops that his father was sending the fruit and the vegetables to. So he knew the Mexican population, the agricultural workers, and he wanted to make an electorate of them and have them represented. I mean, he actually wanted them represented and wanted their support. And so he called them Hispanics. That's where Hispanics came from, was from Richard Nixon. And he established Hispanic Heritage Day. And it was, we don't Nixon. Realize that it was Nixon who did that. And then, of course, what happened was that the media took up Latinos as the word that they were going to use. And so Latinos is actually dominant now, although Hispanics is very much a part of us because there's the Hispanic Heritage Foundation, there is the League of Hispanics. I mean, there are many great institutions that call themselves Hispanic. And then, of course, there was the academic circle, the intelligentsia in the universities that said, well, wait a minute, we want to be inclusive and we want gender equity, so we should use the term Latinx, a term that has never been taken up really en masse by Latinos. I think it's only 2% of people who call themselves or consider themselves Hispanic Latino call themselves Latinx. So, it is. And now there's
Latinx. How do you say it in Spanish? Yo soy Latinexo?
Latinx. it's awkward. I have friends, Juno Diaz, for instance, who is a friend, a wonderful writer, calls himself Latine because it's neutral. And there are certain people who are taking up Latine. So we really are people with no name, and we can't decide who we are.
I'm getting signals that we should go towards the next question, or the next to the last questions before we open it for your questions. But let's go back to your article, last week's article in the Washington Post, in which you talk about the assumptions about Latinos being Republican or not, or Democrat, but the mistakes that can create in this effervescent political period of assuming that all Latinos, this mass that we have been put in under, tend to vote the same way. Because I think it's a very important article, especially at this time.
Thank you very much. The assumption has always been that we must be liberals, we must be Democrats, because we like big government, which isn't necessarily true, but we like big government because it gives us money and it supports us because we're largely poor. That is such a misunderstanding of the population, because I hope you will look for my article in the New York Times, because the Latino population is actually an incredible economic force, a huge economic force. And the Democrats have assumed, well, you need help, you need welfare, which isn't true. Actually, even the undocumented Latinos have zero net effect on the U.S. government budget. I cannot say that about this massive group that has been coming in the last 6 months. But until then, there has the U.S. Census has said very clearly that the effect on the government budget has been zero, net zero. So the assumption that we are looking for handouts isn't true.
Right.
Isn't necessarily at all true. So the Republican, also, we are a population that doesn't vote enough. I mean, there are whole communities in Texas or New Mexico or Arizona that are largely Latino, and they don't go to the polls. 17% since some communities in Texas go to the polls. And so the Republicans very smartly have seen a hole for recruitment. Not only that, but there is this concurrent phenomenon of Latinos becoming evangelicals, leaving the Catholic Church to become evangelicals. Guatemala is now majority Protestant evangelical, which is extraordinary when you think about it. A whole Catholic country has gone majority. Brazil right now is one out of three of the people who go to church in Brazil are evangelical. In this country, more and more. And of course, as we know, the evangelical church very openly encourages you to express yourself at the polls. And so the evangelicals tend to be Republicans, and so definitely on the right side. And so that recruitment has been very successful recently. So you can't count on one side or the other. We are not, I think Latinos are not binary. We don't think blue-red. We don't think, left-right. Left-right means something different when you come from Latin America. Absolutely different. It's a different difference between a dictatorship and a revolution. You know, it's not subtle. And so the affiliations are very fluid. In my own family, my father and mother were Republicans. All the children have become independents and have voted differently in different elections. I certainly have. And I think I'm more typical than as a Latino than most. The liberals have had, in the past, because of the New Deal, was important, I think, to Latinos. That whole business of the New Deal was important, but it's changing, and you cannot count on that swing vote that we talk about all the time.
I think your mother voted for Barack Obama, though, right?
My mother voted for Barack Obama, yes.
I have no opinion on my part. do I have time for one more question? Okay. I think your idea would be to start incorporating Latino history in the school books, in the schools, or in every aspect of possible. At a time in which African-American history is being erased in many states.
Oh, yes.
Out of our educational system. How do you envision bringing Latino culture into the curriculum or into our knowledge of American history in this kind of climate?
It's difficult, but you can't ignore history. I mean, it is there. It is there. I think that those who would erase the critical theory studies, that sort of thing, which is very, very political. Latino history is not political. It's not there. There's not. There's nothing. It's there. It is part of the American story. That is really what I'm trying to get across. Slavery also is part of the American story, and we need to look it squarely in the face. And it has been extraordinary to me in my lifetime, because I remember coming to this country where I didn't know what color I was, and I was looking at signs that said colored whites only, and I didn't know where to go. I was 6 years old the first time I saw that. So that in my own lifetime, I have seen the sea change of sort of American identity. And it has been a very welcome change. I really am very preoccupied about the move to censor or erase history. You cannot do it. It's an impossible task. And what will happen is could be catastrophic if you ignore history. I mean, it comes back to slap you in the face.
Thank you very much for being with us, for writing this book.
Thank you.
And for your calling to the discussion the fact that we need to know more about American history in all its facets.
Thank you. I myself am not Latino, but when I think of the sensibility of people from these varying, and they're very varied, countries from Mexico down to the bottom tip of South America,
all
attached in their sensibility to the Spanish heritage, I'm asking myself, how do the Spanish people in Spain accommodate or navigate or handle their, and to what extent I'm not even sure, that they feel separate from Europe, and also the issue of the fact that Spain was under Islamic control for several centuries. How does that tension play out in Spanish sensibility, if you know? It's just a fascinating question.
In Latin America
question.
Or Spanish from Spain?
No, Spanish from Spain. But I mean, even if you're you're several generations down in South America and purely Spanish, you still have those issues because Spain went through so much. I mean, countries change a lot. Right. It's just very fascinating.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm sure you can answer that question too.
No, but you're the guest here.
The way that I would answer it is, you know, that there are still quite a few people throughout Latin America, in the very elite whites of Latin America, who consider themselves criollo in Spanish, means that you are pure-blooded Spanish living in the Americas. And there are plenty of people who consider themselves criollos in Latin America right now, that fealty to Spain and that respect for Spain still exists to some extent. Certainly, my grandmother thought that she was pure-blooded criolla, and it turns out she was not. I mean, obviously, clearly, in my DNA, she was not. But how does Spain feel about it, the sensibility in Spain? I think Spain itself, as you say so correctly, was a mixed bag. You know, is Moorish dominance in that southern part of Spain for seven centuries, almost eight centuries. There was a reason Ferdinand and Isabella wanted to purge the Arabs from the Spanish territory because it wasn't because they were so strong, and Spain had already a good dose of Arab blood by then, and we can see it in this in the Arabs of Spain. You can see it in Sevilla. You can see it throughout the southern part of Spain, and also the Jewish population, which was so strong and needed to be expelled by Isabella and Ferdinand, and was. So many Jews, we don't know how many because they stopped counting themselves because of the Inquisition, went to Latin America. People are discovering their Jewish blood. So the Sephardic Jews, the Moorish, Spain was a mixed bag, and you see writings of the French and the English, particularly, who were so anti-Spanish, that whole black legend thing, said, Africa starts in the Pyrenees, because Spain is so mixed blood. How Spain feels about it? I can't answer that question.
I know that Spain was, at some point during Franco, was very welcoming to Latin American dictators that had to leave their country.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think I'm the Spaniard in the room, so I will speak as for my country. And what really has happened in Spain is that through literature, Latin America has conquered Spain. Because when in the literary boom with García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, and Cortázar, when they come to Europe, and particularly in Spain and in Barcelona, they become really the world of the new literature and what sells best and the best sellers. So the feeling in academia and in the literary Spain has been very welcoming and very, if you don't know Latin American literature, then you're not, into the politics or the culture of Spain. And so that is a way how Latin America has become so much, they are the new people that came in and took over, really, in Spanish culture. And now I want to address the comment of that Africa starts in the Pyrenees, because I just went to Morocco recently, and you do not say that. Because what happens is that Africa begins in the sub-Sahara. And I found myself as a Spaniard in Morocco not in the Pyrenees at all. No. So, I could go on.
I'm just quoting. That is not my.
Well, there's also that's a novelist and writer Concha Alborg. One of the other benefits of this cultural is that the language, the Spanish language in Spain, has been enriched by the Latin American use of language and use of native language that are incorporated into the Latin American Spanish, so that there is an incredible richness that
absolutely. What you say is so right. The welcoming of Spain, not only of the literature but of the writers themselves. Mm-hmm. There are so many Latin American writers. The strongest writers right now are all living in Spain. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it's a great perch by which to see Latin America.
Yeah. The last thing I would say is that Spaniards in this country are other. I cannot check Latino. I cannot check white, Caucasian. I don't know what color they think we are, but I have to check other. Legally, that's what Spaniards in this country are. So, but that's another story.
Interesting. That's interesting because I think there are those who would want to include you as the Latinos.
That's even when at some point, Puerto Ricans had to say, even the most you know, with more African blood and all that would have to register themselves as white because
yes,
they were Puerto
Rican.
Yes,
a lot of them consider themselves
right.
white. They don't discover that they are black really until somebody calls them that
right.
in the United States.
I wanted to ask you if you consider Latino Land a sister book to Wilkerson's Cast.
To?
Cast. Isabel Wilkerson's book.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Do you know the book called Cast?
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
Yes.
Isabel Wilkerson, yes.
Yes,
yes. Yes. It's a wonderful book.
Yes, it's a wonderful book, and as is yours, I mean, they feel like sister books in a way.
That is the greatest compliment, really the greatest compliment, because Cast is an extraordinary book, and I would be very honored to be compared to it.
Well, tell us a little bit about Cast.
Cast is the story of not only of blacks in America, but of the whole concept of racism. And she so captures that sort of global sense of racism, and not only in this country, but she keeps bouncing the ball elsewhere so that we can see more clearly what we have here, and it's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book. I would be very, very glad if it were considered my book were considered a sister.
Going back to Guatemala the last 2 years, having been away for 25, and living in small villages, and been amazed at the number of evangelical Christians. What caused the
separation?
The separation.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. I think it was liberation theology, is my view. Liberation theology, in which the priests and the church got churches around Latin America got very involved in revolutions and in insurrections. And a lot of people were massacred, killed on both sides of the dictatorships and the revolutionaries. And I think there was a certain weariness that set in. The evangelicals and the Mormons, by the way, who were really very aggressively recruiting in Latin America. I have seen them. I've gone up 18,000 feet into the Andes to do work up there and to interview people up there. And you will see in the stone hut, walking on the mud of the underneath a glacier drip, you will see a sign that says, Kingdom of God congregation, welcome. And the evangelicals and the Protestant missionaries go and live with the people. They live with the people. They wash their clothes in the river along with everybody else. And there is something, and not only that, the fact that, you know, there is such they're part of the lives, but also what they promise. And what it's really quite a beautiful promise, because in the Catholic Church we are taught the poor will inherit the earth. You just have to die first, right? And once you die, you'll go through that you'll go through that transformation, and you will be rich in heaven. The evangelicals, you know, it's what they call economic.
Oh yeah,
theology.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and you can have the riches on earth. Just join us. Work hard. Be good. Don't drink. You know. Don't show up at your job. Be clean. And that has been very persuasive. Yeah, the ambition of Latinos, the work ethic of Latinos, it's a more natural fit than you might think.
May I add one more thing? Maybe you don't agree with me, but there's also the unholy alliance between the Catholic Church and the dictatorships.
Oh,
you know, that
with the conquistadores.
Yeah, exactly. So that said that a lot of the native peoples or the people who are now recruited for evangelicals are people who had seen the Catholic Church as allies,
right,
or as in collusion with the dictators,
right,
who were murderous and made prisoners, so that added to the economic heaven. Mm-hmm. Creates a pretty volatile atmosphere.
Absolutely. Right. It's a, yes, mm-hmm. very complicated story.
Right. I think we have arrived at the end of our Q&A.
Okay.
And we want to thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.